Hello, I'm Jane Crowther, editor of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. And today I'm joined by our reviews editor, Matthew Leyland.
Hello.
Hello. And our deputy editor, Matt Matem.
Hello.
Hello. And we're actually in a room together in real life.
IRL.
Crazy.
The last time we did that, immediate lockdown, so we could be tempting fate. But let's have a go with it. This week, we're weighing up The Eyes of Tammy Faye, Jockey, Belle, The Souvenir Part 2, and Jackass Forever. But before we get on to those, what have you guys been watching? What have you been up to? Matt?
Well, besides these films, I've been watching Encanto a lot. I think
on repeat?
Yes. I think it's sort of punishment because when we reviewed it on the podcast, I basically said I felt like children wouldn't particularly get it or like it. And my son's obviously obsessed with it now, and we watch it constantly. So just to prove me wrong, I think that's why he's doing it, basically.
Is it you that's putting We Need to Talk About Bruno into the, like, the all-time greatest song ever, the GOAT of Disney tunes?
That is on the car a lot, and I kind of now know what all these parents who had children in the time of Frozen like they would let it go.
You know our pain.
So, yeah.
Yeah. What have you been watching, Matthew?
I can never get the title right, but it's the new Kristen Bell show, The Woman in the Window Opposite the... Girl in the house.
Isn't it the woman in the house across the road from the girl in the window?
Yeah, that's that one, yeah.
Where she's an unreliable witness and all sorts of shenanigans go on. I want to see that. Is it any good?
It's weird. It's kind of tonally weird because you kind of expect from the title it's going to be like a straight parody, but it's kind of a mix. It sort of plays it straight and parodic as well, so you don't quite know where it's going. Yeah, it's worth watching. She's really good in it. Mm. It's quite twisted as well and quite funny in places, but yeah, a bit odd.
Twisted and funny. Yes. Got me.
Jane, you've just finished Sundance. What films were you watching there?
Yep, we did Sundance virtually this year, me and Jordan. And there was a surprisingly high amount of good films. And I know that sounds like cynical, but often you go to a festival, you see films... loads of films, and a good half of them are either rubbish or never see the light of day. And this was a high proportion of really good, interesting, and thought-provoking content. But also, I think all of them will get a release. So, you know, one of the themes of Sundance was toxic men. Men who are not what they seem, men who are coercive, men who are abusive, men who murder. Just awful. But some really interesting sort of plays on that. One of the films of the festival that everyone was talking about was Fresh.
That was the only one I had the chance to see.
Yes, and so no spoilers, but it's ostensibly a romance about a girl looking for love in LA and amongst a sort of digital dating scene and the horror of trying to find a decent guy. And can you find a decent guy? The answer's no, but there's more to that. There was also some great horror. Nanny won awards at the festival, and that's about sort of undocumented Senegalese nanny working with a very sort of horrible New York couple and being haunted and by ghosts and spirits. Very, very good, sort of in the vein of Waves and His House. There was also Speak No Evil, which is just, I mean, Matt, you will hate this film. It's just a horrible film to watch. It's about a couple who go on holiday, meet another couple on holiday.
Oh,
they both have
kids. Yes, I heard of this one, yes.
And they go for a weekend at the other couple's house, and it's absolutely excruciating to watch because it's how manners and being polite and not wanting to step outside your middle class being politeness means that you end up in an absolutely terrible situation, and it's truly, truly horrific. So they were great. Right. But there's also great documentaries. There was Amy Poehler's Lucy and Desi documentary, which was using footage and recordings of them telling their own story, which we've never really heard directly from them. There was nice sort of rom-comedy stuff with Cha-Cha Real Smooth and also Am I Okay? And just a really good selection. I loved it. I just wish I'd been in the snow.
I was very jealous seeing all the reactions come up because, like you say, there was a lot of good stuff there. And looking forward to it actually coming out over here.
So yeah, I think Fresh will be out quite soon, actually. So people
can
see that
one. Disney Plus.
Disney Plus. And when you see that film, you'll be like, wow, That's not what I expected on Disney Plus. But say no more about that. Shall we move on to what we can watch before things get to Disney Plus? Shall we see what's on the big screen for this week? It's time for a religious experience. Or not.
Or not.
With this. Jesus keeps a taking me higher and higher. Jim will preach and I'll sing. Higher and higher.
God does not want us to be poor.
Wonderful, a pleasure.
Now God has a voice in this fight.
Who's he fighting?
Liberal agenda. Homosexual agenda.
Faith isn't political.
You can't talk to him like that.
Jerry Falwell is a powerful man, Tammy Faye.
She's a firecracker, Jim.
So this is The Eyes of Tammy Faye. Matthew, how are we tracking Tammy Faye and who is playing Tammy Faye?
Well, Tammy Faye is played by Jessica Chastain. And we've also got Andrew Garfield as her husband, Jim Baker. It's a real-life couple, probably the most well-known televangelists in TV history in America who kind of rose and fell. It's a fairly well-known story even over here, but I won't go into too much of the details. But yes, there is a lot of scandal that erupts as we follow their paths from basically small scale to kind of ruling the airwaves. Tammy Faye sings a lot, I should say. This is this is quite a good week for non-musical films in which the main characters won't stop singing.
Yes,
so
yes, indeed.
There's a lot of songs, yeah. I mean, she absolutely throws herself into this role. There's a lot of prosthetics, a lot of it's well named for her eyes because the eyelashes are quite incredible and the wigs as well.
Yeah, I mean, she was a figure of fun when the scandal hit in the sort of late 80s that she wore a lot of mascara. She had sort of a tattooed lip line. She was never knowingly without like a million bracelets and necklaces and furs and all of that. And, you know, she had she was sort of taken apart by Saturday Night Live and other things he used to do, sort of impressions of her crying with her mascara streaming. And this is really an attempt to get behind that and find out more about the two people at the centre of it. Does it succeed?
Yeah, partly. I mean, I enjoyed it. I found it very watchable. But the tone of it is slightly odd. I mean, there's a couple of scenes where I just didn't know whether to laugh or cry. You know, I felt like doing both at the same time. It's quite sympathetic towards her, I would say. It's quite a sympathetic portrait of her. But at the same time, it's very, very camp as well. There is quite a lot to laugh at, maybe intentionally or unintentionally. It's kind of hard to tell. I felt it maybe lacked a bit of oomph dramatically. I mean, it's always watchable. And, you know, and there's so many montages and musical numbers and costume changes and wig changes that kind of keep it engaging. But perhaps, you know, it doesn't really deliver those kind of high emotional moments.
High emotional moments for you, Matt?
Yeah, I felt very, very similar to Matthew in that I enjoyed it while it was on. I always find these rise and fall sort of narratives quite interesting in that sort of Goodfellas mould. And it was interesting to go into this world I knew very little about, like the televangelism. I didn't really know anything about Tammy Faye Baker and Jim Baker. So it was all kind of new to me. And I don't know if that was a sort of a help or a hindrance because I kind of, while I enjoyed finding out, I came away just not really sure what the point of the film was or what it was trying to say. And I felt like it did make her a bit of a figure of fun to begin with, like especially in the kind of section of the film in her earlier, younger days. I felt like it was kind of mocking her quite a lot. It didn't really, like, I just didn't, just genuinely came away from it thinking, like, I don't know what that's trying to say. And it's a weird thing I find with films where you don't want to be, like, battered over the head with the themes, you know, or have everything completely spelled out. But I just came away thinking, I don't know what you're trying to make me think about her. Like, am I just supposed to feel sorry for her because she was a bit of a sort of patsy when her husband was doing all this kind of dodgy dealing and she got a bit of an unfair go of it? Is that just what I'm supposed to be thinking? And maybe, again, if I was American and had a better understanding and knowledge of them to begin with, maybe this would be sort of subverting my expectations. But coming from it with no knowledge of her or him, I just came away not being sure what I was supposed to think. And I don't know if either of you guys have listened to it, but John Ronson's new podcast, Things Fell Apart, which I sort of listened to over Christmas, there's an episode about Tammy Faye and Steve Peters, who is the guy she kind of interviews on TV in the midst of the AIDS crisis.
AIDS victim.
And that was such a fascinating story. And that was so that was the one bit of background I came to the film with. And you do see that in the film, but it's quite a small part of the film. And so there's, towards the end, we get a bit of a sense that she was a real kind of really supportive of the LGBTQ community. But then I felt like that wasn't really, I was like, well, is that the point you're trying to make? Because it didn't really hammer that point home, that it didn't hammer home how kind of groundbreaking this interview was, I didn't think. And yeah, I basically came away thinking, just not sure what to make of it. But
yeah.
I enjoyed it while it was on. It's very, very campy, cartoony performances, but I enjoyed it if you kind of accept that sort of register they're playing in. I liked Andrew Garfield a lot as well as Jim Baker. He has some, you know, gets buried under some prosthetics at times as well, but I did find him very enjoyable. But yeah, I just couldn't kind of shake that feeling that I just didn't get the point of it.
I think that's the issue with it. Full disclosure, I interviewed Jessica Chastain about this film and talked to her about it, and she has obviously nursed this project from having bought the rights to the story, having seen, obviously there's a documentary of the same name that came out about 20 years ago, which was following Tammy Faye in her latter years as she sort of was on the sort of Bible circuit doing shows, and people were kind of unkind to her, and she had the huge eyelashes and things. And she's nursed this from sort of that point to this and been an executive producer on it. So it's very close to her heart. And her take on it is that it should be about celebrating the fact that Tammy was very much about the message of love, and that she was very accepting. She was an ally. She was a trailblazer. She was sort of questioning the male hold over the sort of Bible belt and all of those things. But I think that the way the film doesn't succeed is in portraying that, really. It's very wishy-washy. It's very kind. It's very soft. It's very closed fist. And it doesn't, you know, ask questions that people would want to ask about this. How much did Tammy Faye know? Was she involved? Was she culpable in any way? Was she completely a patsy, as you seem to think she is? And a lot of people will have very different opinions about that. But
that's what I thought from the film. The way the film presented it, I felt like it was presenting it like she didn't know.
Yeah, like she's quite naive.
But also, I came away not being sure even 100% what Jim was actually doing as well. And I didn't know. Like I noticed there was thanks in the end for their children who are weirdly not on screen really at all, which I also thought was an unusual thing because it's such an important part of their life as a couple, and especially as they have kind of this odd strained relationship for various reasons anyway. I thought it was really weird that we just didn't get a sense of their children and where they were. Yeah, but then I sort of felt like I didn't really, I mean, you kind of get a bit of a sense that he's sort of embezzling perhaps, and, you know, filtering funds perhaps to places they shouldn't be going. But again, I didn't fully get the full sense of what was going on there either, to be honest.
And it seems very keen in making sure that the costumes and the wigs and the teeth and the cheeks and the accents and the nails are spot on, but without really giving the proper context of all of that. You know, she really worked hard to make sure she really sang like Tammy Faye. That, I mean, she talks in this particular kind of way, doesn't she? Tammy Faye, well, Jim. And that's very much like she did. If you do see them at the end,
they do the classic
biopic thing where they show what the real people look like. And yeah, well done, you have nailed it. But as you say, it lacks a focus, doesn't it? But I also think that it could be one of those films that it becomes like a cult thing that people absolutely love, and that you could absolutely watch this film and wear loads of makeup, and you know, you could throw fur coats around and you like a Rocky Horror sort of audience participation.
Drink a Diet Coke every 5 minutes.
Put your straw in your Diet Coke, GM, whenever she says that. You know, like, you could totally have fun with it.
Yeah.
So it's not a terrible film,
I enjoyed it while it was on, but I just kind of afterwards I was like, I just don't know what that was about. Like, that's why I came away thinking, really.
Yeah. This is a classic performance that might net someone awards traction. There is discussion of Chastain being in the awards conversation. Do you think she'll make it when the award nominations out?
It says on the Wikipedia page that she has been nominated for the Academy Award, BAFTA and Screen Actors Guild, but
they haven't been announced yet. Has Jessica put that in?
Yeah, I was just wondering, do they know?
Unless
something?
They mean the long list, maybe? I don't know. But I find it weird when they focus on the long list, to be honest.
Like, yeah.
She'd be going up against people like Kristen Stewart,
Olivia Colman
for The Lost Daughter, various people of that stature. Do you think that there's room in the conversation for this performance?
I think it's got an outside chance,
I definitely think for not being nominated as well.
Surely hair and makeup. Yeah, I mean, it's, yeah. That's nailed on, got to be, hasn't it?
Nailed on, see what you've done on. There. Yes. Tammy Faye did enjoy her nails. So I think...
I can see her being nominated at least.
Okay, so are we saying that we would encourage people to go out and enjoy this?
Yeah, if you're intrigued by the idea and, yeah, if you like her, yeah, definitely.
But maybe you will, I mean, I don't know, but maybe you will just benefit from watching the documentary first or doing a bit of reading up about it first.
And then you'd be able to see just how much she nailed
that
interview with that guy on telly where she was wearing her sort of doily dress and crying at the screen, which is, you know, word for word, pretty much exactly how it went. Okay, so that is The Eyes of Tammy Faye, which is out in cinemas on Friday. Do take a can of Coke and a straw because that is what Tammy does throughout. Okay, shall we look at our next film? What are the odds on this racer?
Out of all the things you do in life, there's that 1 minute that you feel like you're the most important thing in the world because everybody's watching you.
I was a great jockey for a little while.
How you doing, Jax?
I'm doing real good. I'm feeling good.
Just tell me what's going on.
It's just wear and tear.
You've done some damage. You need to get yourself to a doctor.
You are a doctor.
I'm a horse doctor.
You seen that new kid been training at Jerry's barn? Yeah, he can ride.
Coming across the stress. That's right. Let him feel it. I'm going to push back. I'm going to push back. Push back. Push back.
So this is Jockey. Matt, what's it about?
I'm going to shock you and say this is the story of a jockey. And he's played by Clifton Collins Jr., who is a character actor. And if you looked up that guy in the dictionary, you would see a picture of his face because he's been in just so much stuff, like including Nightmare Alley, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, Honey Boy, Scott Pilgrim, Capote, Traffic, just loads of stuff. Like
totally that guy.
Yes, you've definitely seen his face in something before. But I feel like I haven't seen him in a lead role before. And here he is, the jockey, Jackson Silver. And he's kind of coming to the end of his time as a rider. Probably this is going to be his last season due to various sort of physical ailments and things. Into his life comes a young man who claims to have a sort of connection with him. You can probably guess where this is going. And then the film sort of follows these two men at different stages of their career and digs into the sort of minute detail of the sort of jockey lifestyle and the training and everything like that that goes into it. So it's very much a film in the mould of something like The Wrestler or The Rider, in that, you know, you're kind of following someone at this kind of stage of their career. And even just the way it's shot and the style of the performances and the style of the film, it's very much trying to be that kind of film.
So this was a Sundance film. It's very much the kind of Sundance film you'd expect.
Yeah.
And you mentioned that it's sort of similar to other films. Is it different enough, Matthew, to retain your attention, or is it very much what you've seen before?
Yes, very much what you've seen before. I found it watchable enough. It's quite short. It's like 94 minutes, which seems like a sensible length. But it does run into quite a few cliches and doesn't really reinvigorate them. It's kind of got this quite gritty sheen to it. But underneath, the story is quite formulaic. It's very easy to predict what the beats are going to be and what the twists are going to be. It's a great looking film. There's some really lovely sunsets throughout.
Beautiful cinematography. Yeah. This is in Phoenix as well, isn't
sunsets,
it?
Yeah.
So yeah, you're getting loads of great sunsets and dawns
with
horses riding at dawn. It's beautiful.
Yeah. Mm. Although not actually much horse racing action. They kind of shoot the horse racing in a quite a sort of low budget way, really. So I don't go in expecting lots of exciting thundering of hooves all over the place. It's not kind of like Seabiscuit. It's much more
but
about
who
characters.
Wants a Seabiscuit? I didn't love that.
No, really.
Did it do it for you, Matt?
Similar to Matthew. Maybe I liked it a tiny bit more than he did. I was kind of very much kept my attention, but yeah, there was a lot to sort of admire about it, like from the sort of craft to the performances. Like Clifton Collins Jr. I thought was very good. Molly Parker, who's another kind of character actor who has never really had a huge breakout role, who I will always think of her from Deadwood, really. She's also really good as this sort of horse trainer that he's sort of partnered up with, and he's sort of worked with a lot over the years, and they have this kind of, you know, sort of relationship. And there is a feeling of authenticity in this world. And the director, Clint Bentley, his father was a jockey and sort of seemed to go through a sort of similar thing. You do get the sense, I do like it with a film when you really get to sort of dig into a world you're just not familiar with, and like the training and things like that. I always enjoy that sort of thing. But ultimately, I did come away feeling a bit like, yeah, I wasn't particularly like emotionally moved by it. I didn't get like particularly invested in the characters. It was just sort of, you know, perfectly solid while it was on, but I wouldn't give it like a really hard recommendation for people to, like, you know, go out to the cinema to see it, to be honest.
Yeah, I sort of felt like I wanted to see the documentary of this because they have real jockeys in the film, don't they, who are talking about, you know, when they start to go into all the ways they've broken their bodies, and there's bones that I didn't know you could break falling off a horse, and the sort of the regime for losing weight, and the, and you know, the fact
that you
sweat it off, or you know you have to eat you know, half an apple and put the other half of it back in the fridge because that's your dinner. Those sort of elements I found fascinating, and the weighing in and the fact that, you know, like any sportsman, there's a limited time on how long you can do this well before, he says at one point, you know, what your mind and your body think are two different things. And while you may be raring to continue this career, your body just isn't up to it. And where do people like that go? If you haven't made the money you need to, then what do you do for the rest of your life? And so I liked that aspect of it. But yeah, I have to agree with you guys. It was very, very similar to a lot of things I've seen before. And when you think about The Rider, Chloe Zhao's film, that sort of does this better for me, and I did it first. So yeah, I didn't feel I was seeing anything new.
And that leaned more on the real riders, and you're getting that sort of, you know, like semi-documentary approach. Whereas this, you know, you don't get as much of that, which perhaps maybe it would work better if you had more of it in this sort of film.
Yeah. But. Okay. So that is out in cinemas. Are we telling people to go see this, or is that something to wait for home ends?
I think home end, really.
I can't see it setting the box office alight.
Yeah.
All right, so that is not First Past the Post, but that is Jockey, and it's in cinemas from Friday. Right, it's time for Plain Talking. What is diegetic music?
I'm going to think back to my sort of media studies days here, and I always used to get them confused, but I'm hoping I get the right way around. Is diegetic music where the music exists in the world of the film?
Yes.
And yes, so if a character is listening to the radio or blasting out their car stereo, that would be diegetic music. And if it was non-diegetic, that's when the soundtrack plays over that we, the audience, are listening to, but obviously the characters aren't hearing.
But obviously there is the thing where you do it both. So you open with a soundtrack, and then somebody like clicks that soundtrack off as it goes into a radio, so it like it goes both ways.
Yeah.
So you can use diegetic and non-diegetic music together.
That really blew my mind when I first saw Eyes Wide Shut. That's what always sticks with me for that, when you hear this music kind of, you know, playing over the beginning, and then I think it's Tom Cruise's character then just turns the radio off and it stops. And you're like, oh my God, that was actually diegetic music. I thought it was non-diegetic.
And there's a bit at the start of the League of Gentlemen movie, you hear this really ominous, suspenseful music, and it just turns out to be someone's ringtone. I'm sure a gag's been done a few times.
Yes, indeed. Fantastic. Okay, shall we continue then on to the next film we can see this week? It's time to log on for this.
Welcome to the world of you. You may not be able to start over in the real world, but you can start over in the world of you.
With its unique body-sharing technology, you was able to draw out a user's hidden strength.
I can finally sing again.
She made it on Yu's global music charts, just as I expected.
I'm so dead!
Nobody in their right mind would ever guess that Bell's user is actually a mousy nobody like you.
I guess it's true that everyone's hiding some kind of secret.
This is Bell.
Bell.
Bell, Matthew. Yes. Tell us about it.
Well, this is an anime film from Mamoru Hosoda, who got an Oscar nomination for Mirai, also directed films such as Wolf Children and The Boy and the Beast. And as you might be able to guess from the title, it does have quite a strong connection to Beauty and the Beast. Although there is a lot more to it. The protagonist is this young teenage girl called Suzu, who's lost her mother as a young girl and has become quite introverted. She loves music, but she finds it very difficult to sing. She can't do karaoke with her friends.
I mean, that is shocking on its own, isn't it?
Yeah.
Not being able to do karaoke.
Yeah. One of life's great pleasures.
It is.
But she does create this other identity in this, using this app called You, which kind of maps your biometric information into a new fabulous avatar, and she becomes this Disney princess-esque singer who kind of takes the internet by storm. And then eventually she comes into contact with this character called the Dragon, who seems to be disrupting everything that's going on. And then the kind of Beauty and the Beast plot develops from there, and it takes it in quite original and inventive directions. And it kind of jockeys back and forth between the real world and the world of you.
I like the way you've used the word jockey there, yes. Just to throw back to our previous film. Yeah. So are we talking about this as a dubbed film, or is this subtitled?
It's both. It's available in both versions. So is the soundtrack as well. And the dub is really good. It's the singing's really good in the dubbed version. They've done a really good job. I mean, I know some purists don't really like dubbed versions, but they've taken a lot of care with this. Especially with the songs, which are really integral to the to the film.
Now, I know you're a bit of a nerd for this, and you were probably predispositioned to enjoy it. But where does it sort of rate on your scale of this? Like, is this an absolute corker?
Absolute corker. Absolute, utter corker. I adored it. I've seen it twice. I've got the soundtrack. I'm going to go and see it again.
Going to get the T-shirt.
Yeah.
Going to get this cuddly toy.
Yeah.
What about you, Matt?
I really liked it. Not quite as much as Matthew, but I would like to revisit it and have another go on it, because I came to this knowing the sort of flood of five-star reviews, including in Total Film, of course. And I really, really liked it. But I wasn't completely sold by the time the ending came around, to be honest. But it's really a visually amazing world they go into. I love the whole idea of the sort of the tech and the way it sort of brings them into the world in a way, like Matthew said, that draws on their own kind of biometrics when they're creating these avatars. I loved the sort of the beast type character, you know. I loved the way he looked. And there's these characters, I can't remember what they're called, Matthew, you probably can tell me, but the ones that go around policing.
The Justices.
Yeah, the Justices, yeah.
Justin and the Justices.
I love those kind of flying around. I saw this on the small screen, but I would love to see it on the big screen just because of all that kind of visual detail and just how much is going on in this world. Yeah, and it goes sort of interesting places. It doesn't. I knew about the Beauty and the Beast connection before seeing it, but it doesn't. It's not like it's just a complete Beauty and the Beast template.
No.
There's elements of that, but it's quite different. So again, that was another thing where on first viewing, it sort of I was perhaps expecting a straighter Beauty and the Beast story. So knowing what to expect, I imagine it will play a bit differently second viewing. But it was really, really very good.
Mm. I did not see this. I was sundanced up to the eyeballs, so I didn't see it. But it does sound lovely. Is it something that kids can enjoy as well as adults?
That's a tricky one, because it does kind of get into some quite dark themes. The Beauty and the Beast plot is kind of a setup for a kind of a bigger reveal. Teenagers, definitely, but not really younger children, even though there's a lot of razzle dazzle and some very catchy songs in it as well. It does kind of get into darker territory, especially towards the end. Very emotional.
You've watched it twice already. Have you
I
had
have
a little cry
both times?
Did it make you weep?
No, it didn't. No, but could do on a second viewing. It is interesting where it goes, and it didn't make me weep, but I felt quite emotional at certain scenes, so it wasn't like I felt nothing, it just didn't quite cross over into the tear ducts leaking. But there was a lot of moving stuff in there. Even like from Matthew said from the beginning, just the idea of the girl's mum dying is quite sad, and the way you kind of see the sort of flashbacks to that early on and how that sort of affects her is upsetting.
So I think we'd highly recommend this one, yes? This is a sort of feast for the eyes and ears, and quite a sort of different cinematic experience.
Mm.
Okay, so this is Belle, and it is out in cinemas on Friday. Probably worth seeing on a big screen as well.
Oh, God, yeah.
With the beautiful visuals. Okay, it is time for another sequel. There's so many sequels around. Here's another one.
Patrick. Hi.
How's your film?
Good.
Did you avoid the temptation to be obvious?
I think so.
That's all you can hope for, isn't it?
One.
This is The Souvenir Part 2, a follow-up to Joanna Hogg's first film, The Souvenir, as you might have guessed. Matt, maybe you should set us up what The Souvenir 1 gave us and where this now finds the characters.
Yeah, well, this is interesting. I was wondering about this because this is one of those rare films where you absolutely have to have seen the first one, really. Like, I mean, I suppose that with anything, you could come to this. I mean, I obviously had seen the first one first, so I don't know what it's like to come to it cold, but they were designed to be kind of watched back to back, really, and they were almost shot back to back, but ended up writer-director Joanna Hogg decided to sort of film one at a time. In the first film, really, without necessarily spoiling it in case you haven't seen it, you do need to catch it before you watch this one. But we basically follow a young film student called Julie, who's very much based on Joanna Hogg, really, like that's been said. It's quite obvious. And she's played by Honor Swinton Byrne, who's the daughter of Tilda Swinton, and Tilda Swinton plays her mum in the film as well. In the first film, it was largely really all about her relationship with this kind of mysterious, slightly older man called Anthony, played by Tom Burke, very magnetically.
Does a good line in magnetic, he does, sort of dangerous fellas.
He really does. And so that whole first film was really about their relationship and her kind of, you know, experiencing this kind of grown-up world whilst, you know, making her very first steps as a sort of student filmmaker, you know, trying out what she wanted to make as a film, basically, like, and going, having these different people telling her not to do certain things, you know, and this, it kind of plays with that idea of privilege, because she's obviously very privileged, lives in Knightsbridge and clearly comes from an extremely wealthy family. And she's looking at making a story set in Sunderland against a sort of, you know, a lower economic background. And there's the whole question of, you know, is that her story to tell? What story should she be telling, etc.? But then this second film picks up after sort of that relationship has ended, and it pretty much picks up, you know, very soon after. But this time we're much more seeing her then going on to make her student film and kind of basically channeling those experiences from the first film into this student film that she's making, which is why you really do need to have seen the first one to fully take this one on board. And then it just goes from there, really. It's sort of her experience making that film.
This is another one of those films that's an autobiographical kind of film, like Almodovar has done one recently, Branagh's done one recently, but this is also another one of those films that's very much about the pursuit of art and how artists create art, like Tick, Tick, Boom did it recently. Is that weirdly alienating if you're not in that, you know, world of making films and you know, having an absolute meltdown about your camera angle when, in a world where we've just gone through, you know, COVID, is it relatable?
Possibly. I mean, I'm a bit biased because I just absolutely love films about filmmaking and seeing sort of behind the scenes of making films. There's a lot of awkwardness with the crew and things going wrong. And then we also see, there was a character we briefly meet in the first film, played by Richard Ayoade, Patrick, who's a kind of, you know, sort of an established young filmmaker.
An auteur.
Yeah, and he's and we kind of also get to see, you know, his film that's being made and some of the sort of strife behind the scenes of that. And his film looks terrible, doesn't it? But he's just absolutely hilarious. And he's kind of railing against this, not wanting to make a kind of drizzly sort of British film. But yeah, he's kind of one of the sort of standout supporting performances of recent months for me, even though he's not really in it that much. But I absolutely loved him in it. And yeah, like I say, I loved seeing these kind of awkward and behind the scenes things with Julie's film. And there's things like, you know, they're getting fed up because she sometimes doesn't seem to know what she wants.
She's the director with no direction.
Yeah. And they're doing a scene and she's like, oh, actually, yeah, this should be at night, you know. And they're getting a bit fed up and they get these arguments and these blow ups. So I found all that really interesting. Maybe it could be alienating, I'm not sure. But I was interested, just really want to get your guys' thoughts on it, because I liked both films a lot, but I didn't absolutely love them. And I know some people have been blown away by both parts.
I mean, they've been awarded loads of awards. They've also, you know, this film is being nominated for loads of awards as well. Critically acclaimed, hugely critically acclaimed. But is that, you know, a weird elitism in itself, Matthew?
I don't know, hard to say, really. Yeah, I mean, it does seem to be kind of appealing to a certain type of audience. It's certainly not a universal experience, I would say. And certainly just from the point of view of, yeah, you do need to see the first one, really. Seeing this in isolation, it's not one of those sequels that kind of works on its own. It's very much part two. I love the first one, but I did find this comparatively disappointing, partly because Tom Burke's just not in it, because he was such a central character in the first one, and the impact he had on the other characters gave that such dramatic heft, whereas this one it feels like there's a bit of a void, which is kind of intentional because of the way the narrative goes. But yeah, you really do miss him. And I think Honor Swinton Byrne does a good job, and Tilda's fantastic as usual, even just like hosing her garden.
No
one does it like that, or telling the dogs to get out of the room and stuff like that. But yeah, I felt it a little bit of a letdown. But I mean, there was always something to enjoy. I enjoyed all the behind the scenes shenanigans and Richard Ayoade's tantrums on set. That was all good fun. And the 80s soundtrack, I like that as well.
Which, not necessarily quite right from a year point of view if you're a nerd like that, but still absolute crackers. Yeah, they're always a few years out, aren't they? And 80s fashion as well, which is basically what everyone's wearing now all over again. I totally agree with you guys. Like, I loved Tilda in this. The scenes with her parents felt so much more authentic than the scenes that we saw with her colleagues at the film school. It's exactly like your own parents' conversations, and you know just the way she comes in, and the way she, Tilda's character is learning to make vases, and she's made this a terrible pot that she's incredibly proud of, and the dad is sort of like, oh, I like your pajamas, and she's like, they're not pajamas, you know, like she's wearing fashion, and her dad's like, oh, well, they're very nice. Just these lovely sort of parents that just beautifully done. And Ayoade, I would wanted more of him. I just loved what he was doing. He's not doing it overtly comedy. He is incredibly funny to watch. And, you know, he's got this sort of frosted tips hair, and he's creating this terrible film that looks awful and has this conviction and has like, and he's like, you're forcing me to have a tantrum now. He's so great. But I found the rest of it incredibly self-indulgent, navel-gazing, wishy-washy nonsense. I mean, I understand you're supposed to put your own interpretation on it, but my interpretation was, God, these people don't have enough to worry about. I just found them very irritating and sort of indulgent.
Well, that's kind of the same in all her films, though, Jaron. I mean, I love her films.
Sort of, privileged young people wishy-washing about, and all of the sort of, you know, just endless conversations behind cameras and in minibuses. I just wanted Ayoade back. Like, come back, Tilda, come back, Ayoade. That's what I wanted more of. But yeah, if you want an idea of what it's like on a film set, and probably what it's very much like on a student film set, I mean, because if you've been on a film set, no one would take that long fannying about, would they, when there's money at stake? But if you want to really understand what that's like, I guess it's a really good window into that experience. And I do appreciate that it's Joanna Hogg's most personal two films to date. And the fact that, you know, the student film she's making is actually called The Souvenir. I get it, but it's just left me cold. I prefer her other work. I love Archipelago. I love Unrelated. I love Exhibition. I found they had much more driving them narratively than this does. And yeah, Tilda's daughter is very watchable. And you know, she's so much like her mother, isn't she, to watch? So that's sort of distracting on its own level.
She was actually one aspect of the film that I was a bit cold on, actually, in both films. So I thought she was like fine, but I wasn't kind of blown away by her, I must be honest. I don't know if it's kind of, I felt like it was probably an intentional character choice, but I just found her a little bit kind of blank, almost as if she's just there for us to sort of experience the world through her. But I wasn't hugely taken with it.
I kind of thought that was an intentional choice. With this film, I sort of found like, if I didn't like it and I was explaining, oh, I think it's a choice, then it was like, why am I having to think that? I wish it was just happening to me. I wish I was just experiencing it rather than having to analyze it and decide what was intended for me to think and go, I see, that's very arch and clever, well done.
Yeah.
And I think that's what I disliked about it.
I think the first one was just more relatable as well, because it had this big relationship romance that goes quite bad. So I think everyone could kind of watch that and feel some sort of relation to it. Whereas with this, it does feel maybe a little bit more elitist, focusing on this art school filmmaking.
Indeed. Okay, so this is The Souvenir Part 2, which is available in cinemas on Friday. Okay, so now it's time for alternative line reading. And this is connected to one of the stars we've already talked about. This is one of their famous lines in a very famous film. I might do it in the style of Tammy Faye. You better lawyer up, assholes, because I'm not coming back for 30%. I'm coming back for everything.
Very good. I know what this one is immediately, so do you know better?
No, I don't know, actually. Is it not Social Network, is it? Andrew Garfield?
Ba-boom!
Is it?
Andrew Garfield.
That obviously was a guess. Yeah.
It is. It's Andrew Garfield when he has been betrayed by Jesse Eisenberg and Justin Timberlake, and he comes back in the office to let them know he's not going away quietly. And it sounds like this.
You did it. I I knew you did it. You planted that story about the chicken.
I didn't plant the story about the chicken.
What's he talking about?
You had me accused of animal cruelty.
Seriously, what the hell's the chicken?
And I'll bet what you hated the most is that they identified me as a co-founder of Facebook, which I am. You better lawyer up, asshole, because I'm not coming back for 30%. I'm coming back for everything.
I love that film, and I remember that clip doing the rounds a lot.
Yes, a cracking film, and so many stars that are still working today that are making their sort of debut in there. Like, I totally forgot Dakota Johnson's in that film, her first cinematic outing. Okay, so it's time now, just after the art, after the, you know, the deep philosophicalness, to go somewhere completely different. It's time for just some absolute idiocy, and we're here for it.
Hello, I'm Johnny Knoxville. Welcome to Jackie.
A lot of people ask, what will Jackass be like once we're older? Well, it'll get more mature.
The faster you pedal your bike, the faster the other guy's hand goes back.
You said it wasn't gonna feel like anything.
Concussions aren't great, but as long as you have them before you're 50, it's cool. And Knoxville's 49, so we're good.
So this is Jackass Forever. For those of us not aware of Jackass and what that means, Matthew, tell us, what is Jackass Forever about?
Well, it's a very, very simple concept. If you haven't seen a Jackass movie before, I don't think you'll be too lost with it. It's basically a group of guys led by Johnny Knoxville abusing their bodies, doing stunts and pranks to themselves and each other, and suffering great levels of pain for theirs and our amusement, and that's essentially it. It started at the turn of the century, I think, on TV, and became such a big hit that it spawned three movies. The last one was Jackass 3D, which was 2010, so it's been a while. But a lot of the old gang are back, and they've got some new recruits as well. There's a guy called Jasper and his dad, and a lady called Rachel, who I think is the first female Jackass to be part of the team. Plus all the other regulars like Wee Man and Steve-O, and of course Johnny Knoxville himself.
No Ryan Dunn, obviously, no. Because Ryan Dunn passed away, yeah. And there's some fisticuffs with Bam, so they are, the original team members are not in it. Now, yes, so this is like a thing that's a classic for people who are aware of it, and you were a fan of this, Matthew, before.
Yeah, I like the early films, yeah.
So is this making you laugh with these now older men, these are middle-aged men and dads now, whacking themselves in the balls repeatedly in various different methods?
Yeah, I kind of felt, I mean, if you've seen one Jackass movie, you sort of, well, if you've seen three, I didn't feel it was right. I did laugh, I did chuckle, there were a few things, some really just simple things, like a guy just tripping on some steps. I thought that was very funny. I did find it a bit repetitive, especially with the amount of testicle damage. I kind of got a bit weary of seeing balls being punched and pummeled and generally abused.
And pogo sticked. Somebody pogo sticks onto somebody's testicles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's a lot of bruising. Yeah. There's a lot of vomit.
A lot of bruising.
There's semen.
Yeah, vomit.
There's always semen. An animal semen item.
Yeah. Not too much poo this time.
Not so much poo. There was firing out of a human cannon, farting,
animals.
Lighting farts, animals, a hungry bear and an angry bull. There's broken bones, everything you might expect. Now, you were kind of underwhelmed. I loved it and laughed it, like a drain throughout, like literally laughed out loud, which very rarely happens because it's so dumb and so stupid and sort of a lovely, mindless thing to watch. Matt, you had never seen a Jackass before. How did it work out for you?
No, yeah, I came to this fairly cold because, of course, coming of age around that time, I was, of course, aware of the show and I've seen clips and things, but I don't know if I've even ever sat down and watched a full episode, and I definitely had never seen any of the previous films. And I pretty much hated this almost from the start. Like, from the very beginning, I don't know how true this is, if Jackass has ever done anything like this before, but there's a weird sort of like filmmaking kind of stunt that's sort of, you know, a weird fictionalized bit at the beginning. which I thought was quite funny. It's kind of so ridiculous and ludicrous and disgusting. But I sort of thought that was kind of funny. And I smirked a few times. As Matthew mentioned, for me, sometimes it was just some of the simpler stuff, like someone just tripping over, that was sort of funnier than some of the more elaborate things. But then I just pretty much hate it. And it was, we have a phrase which you must have mentioned on the podcast before, which is like make it end films. And it's often reserved for like sort of really arty farty, you know, foreign language films that sort of, you know, where you can't get on that wavelength. But this was just a make it end film for me from about 10 minutes in. And I should say as well that it's obviously got pretty, it's got very good reviews across the board, really. Like a lot of kind of highbrow critics have given it 4 stars. You know, it seems to be.
We gave it 2.
Our Jamie Graham was kind of an outlier on that, but I'm very much behind him. There's so many things. Like one of the main things I really disliked about it, which again I haven't really seen mentioned in many reviews, is the treatment of animals in it. Like whilst they have the American Humane accreditation at the end, so I'm sure it was all above board, but I still felt very uncomfortable in this day and age seeing animals kind of, you know, being sort of agitated to so that they harm people. To me, that's just not, I was not comfortable seeing that. I wasn't comfortable seeing scorpions being kind of, you know, flicked so they would sting someone. I wasn't comfortable seeing like a vulture brought out to a group of like leery lads just kind of shouting. And I realize I sound like a completely grumpy old man saying all this as well, because again, I say this, we were in a busy screening of it last night in a kind of big cinema screen, and there was ridiculously loud laughter, which again had me feeling like I was living in some kind of parallel world, because I just didn't know what people were getting out of this. Yeah, I just felt like, as someone who hadn't grown up with the show or anything like that, I found pretty much all the characters detestable. I say characters, you know, the people detestable. There was a couple that I liked. I know obviously who Johnny Knoxville is and Steve-O, because of them being the more famous ones. But you're kind of given these people's names, but obviously there's no chance of learning who these people really are. But there was a very heavy set younger guy who I found quite endearing. And another of the younger guys who sort of brought his dad in later, I found him quite funny as well. But the others, they were just like these kind of 50-something men sort of dressing like kind of skater boy teens who have clearly never grown up. And I think if they were like characters in a sort of fictional film, we would just absolutely loathe them. And we would be like, you know, what are we watching? But for some reason, people were just loving it. And it just went completely over my head, I'm afraid.
Well, I'm a diehard Jackass fan. I watched it, all the shows. I've watched all the films repeatedly. I still find it amusing when people are shot into the air out of an air mattress in a furniture shop. I find it funny when they punch people, they're queuing up for coffee and they get smacked in the face by an inflatable that comes out the coffee truck.
Kick yourself in the head, wee man.
It is funny to me. And I think it's funny to me, possibly not going in cold, because I have grown up with them. They are characters. These people surely do not behave like this in real life, because they'd be arrested. People would be suing them for assault. And the characters that they play are very consistent. And this is very consistent. And some of the stunts they do are callbacks. And the guy behind the camera who always throws up at anything gross, he's like a stalwart, and you know that. And it's funny to see him do that because he's always done that. And the director
again,
is
that was
director.
That was another of the few things that I cracked up at him gagging.
Yeah. And he's famous for that. That's what he does. And you know that there was a little glimpse of Party Boy, one of my favorite sort of stunts. Steve-O and getting his knob out is just, you know, rote. We've seen that loads of times. So for me, it was sort of a nostalgia warmth as well. And I like them because they're sort of those idiots I've grown up with. So I feel more warm towards them. But I get what you're saying. Should we be getting a bear in a room with a man covered in salmon? Probably not, but it's dumb.
I completely lack the nostalgia. And funnily enough, when I was walking home from the screening yesterday, I bumped into a couple of people I know and was explaining to them what I'd seen. And they literally said, oh, they have really nostalgic feelings towards Jackass. So I'm sure that, again, a lot of people have that. But what I found, and I obviously was familiar with the format from, you know, just cultural knowledge, you know, it's obviously was such a huge thing. But I found over 93 minutes or however long it was, I really found it really draining, because you just get these such short skits and they just jump from one thing to the next. And I didn't, again, I realize this sounds silly to be even asking for this, but with no real structure, like they kind of end on a, you know, a fairly big thing. So it kind of builds up to a fairly big stunt, but it's not like it's kind of building in any way. It's not like, it's obviously, again, the nature of the show, just very random who does what. I found it also like this slightly redeemed itself by the end, because Johnny Knoxville did do this very big dangerous thing at the end where he seemed to get quite badly hurt. But I found something uncomfortable about the way he was sort of the ringleader doing everything and not really getting involved. I don't know why. I just found it quite annoying. I was like, and I didn't really feel comfortable the way people were just being like kicked in the balls and stuff. You know, it's but just again, a little extra it's, before they start their challenge. That has always happened.
You know? Johnny Knoxville has always, you know, done a sly sidekick into the balls whilst presenting a segment. Mm. That is a classic Jackass thing. So it's kind of funny because it's always happened.
I felt a bit like Jane, but one thing that did come to me is I was thinking, had in mind very much what you said about Scream after we sort of saw that and reviewed that recently, in that I wondered if I've just reached an age where, and I realize again, I'm sounding like such an old man, which I, you know, I'll own, but I feel like I've reached an age where just seeing people disrespect their bodies in that way was just uncomfortable to me. Like, it was just sort of kind of, I don't know, just where we're at in the world, people abusing their genitals and, you know, particularly their testicles in that way. It just didn't feel right. It didn't feel right. And then obviously there's occasional times where there's medics running in, and I'm thinking, like, you know, these people have got like medical training, and they're there to sort of, you know, they're here to save lives, and, you know, just something didn't sit right with me about people just intentionally like harming themselves for fun. It just felt wrong.
I disagree. Yeah, I know. I totally understand what you're saying, but this is what these guys do. They are these dumbasses that, you know, like, yeah, you can pogo stick onto my nads, or you can, you know, shoot a hockey puck straight into the balls. Presumably they sign cast iron waivers to say that they'll be happy if a ball drops off, or, you know, what have you. They're adults. They know what they're doing.
The insurance and the waivers.
I mean, the insurance must
be
astronomical. Yeah.
And I suppose, again, if I may say something positive about it, I thought there were a few things that were quite well shot, in the sense of like when people were like slip and sliding down, you know, these huge kind of hills, and then launching off at the end. They were quite well filmed in slow-mo at times. You know, that was quite impressive. So
slow-mo is kind of probably developed since the last one, so you can really capture the
every ounce wibble of
pain
of
better than ever before.
Yeah, your face reverberating from a ball being shot at great speed off your head.
Yeah, what technology has given us.
It is indeed. So it's not for you, Matt. It's kind of for you, Matthew. It's so for me.
It's very much a film. You know, if it's for you, really, don't you, or not? Like, yes. Because you sort of knew you were going to love it before, Jay, didn't you? And I know you were like kind of desperately excited to see it, and obviously loved it. Jordan of this parish also loved it, and he's a sort of fan who was looking forward to it. So clearly, if you think you're going to like it, you probably will. You know.
Yeah.
Jordan and I sat next to each other, and I'm very pleased. I have to say, I wasn't sat next to you, Matt, because you'd have really harshed my vibe. But Jordan and I were sat there laughing, gasping, going no at various things that happened, and we had a whale of a time. For 90 minutes we forgot the world, nothing else mattered but what the next dumb thing was going to be, and that was a pleasure to me to have complete escapism, which is what it was for me. I didn't think about
it. Really exists in a vacuum, doesn't it? Apart from a few people wearing masks you see throughout, and so they obviously must have filmed some during the pandemic, but apart from that, yeah, it could have been made.
Yeah, you don't have to follow a narrative, you don't have to look for clues, you don't have to be like, what does this mean, why are they using that trope, like where will this go, what's going to happen. You don't have to use your brain at all. It is literally a brainless film in every sense, and if that's your bag, that can be a nice escape.
I'm surprised to see a couple of reviews refer to, like, because I was reading some positive reviews last night, because again, I was interested to see what other people were getting out of it that I wasn't. And I was very interested to see some people calling it like heartfelt and things like that, which I just didn't get that at all. Did you feel that about it, Jane?
Well, I guess because of the thing at the end, that there's a tribute to Ryan Dunn and the fact that, you know, lost friends, and that they're sort of still doing this stuff, but, you know, they're still, you know, mourning the loss of their friend who died in a car accident.
The dedication to him at the end, I only kind of got that. I knew that a member had died, but I don't know, I didn't feel like that they mentioned him throughout until that point, did they?
No, they didn't mention him. But he does feature in some flashback stuff. He's the guy covered in feathers and the guy on the like motor scooter that's ramming everyone in the office. And I guess it's sort of heartfelt if you think about, maybe it makes you think about your own friendship group. You know, if you grew up with some lads that you do stupid stuff with, Jamie Graham is famous for his stories of the Melksham lads and what they do when they go on holiday and the silly stuff they do and the drinking of hot sauce and various other stunts that they get up to. So yeah, maybe if you have a friendship group like that, that has done silly things and is growing older and still there's that element of being stupid together, maybe you do get the heartfelt sort of aspect of it out of it. But clearly you're getting nothing out of it, so we won't make you talk about this anymore. But if you are a Jackass fan, then it's a treat, and it is available from Friday in cinemas. Get a beer, get your mates, have a laugh, forget the world. That's what I say. And that's Matthew Leyland's little kitten just mewing in the background.
Can you hear it?
Yes.
What's the matter?
Oh dear.
Did she like Jackass?
She wants to go out.
Well, I reckon she'd like it, yeah.
So that's it for this week. But before we go, we should mention there's another release out today, Thursday. What is it, Matt?
It's the new issue of Total Film Magazine.
Yay!
Featuring one of my most anticipated films of the year to prove I'm just not a total grump about everything, The Batman. I'm just a mega Batman fan, like a lifelong Batman devotee. So I'm obviously super excited about this film. And For this issue, I spoke to director Matt Reeves, Robert Pattinson, and like all the major cast members, like Zoe Kravitz, Paul Dano, Peter Sarsgaard, John Turturro, Andy Serkis, put some questions to Colin Farrell, even, who played
Jeffrey Wright.
New version. Jeffrey Wright, who's the
It's
new
like
James
you
Gordon.
Got the scoop on so everybody.
It was, yes, it was a very, very good experience for a Batman fan like me. And of course, I hope other Batman fans enjoy reading it, and it's out now, so you can just get it and read it now.
Yeah,
print or digital, you know, whatever you fancy.
Whatever floats your boat. It's a really good issue. It's out in shops now, or it's available digitally, and it has a lot of other good stuff. If you're not a Batman fan, there's loads of other stuff. There's a great interview with Aubrey Plaza. There's a wonderful feature on the art of films and creating a Batmobile and Bond things. That's a really interesting feature. There's our comfort films. There's a feature on our very favourite comfort films, which mine was Groundhog Day. Matthew, yours was?
Sign of the Times, Prince.
Just loads of good stuff, and all your films reviewed and rated. So please go out and buy it, because it's a cracker. What's your film of the week? What are you sending people out to the theatres to see, Matthew?
Belle, my film of the year, not just the week.
It is only February, though.
I know, but
I've gone hard on that one, okay.
I'm going to have to agree and say Belle as well for film of the week this week.
I'm going to say Jackass. I've always loved them. I will always love a stupid stunt, so that's mine. Okay, so before we go, we have time for a reader's question. Are you ready for this one? What's your favourite movie involving cake?
I'm going to go for Matilda, the Danny DeVito one with the scene where I think George has to eat this chocolate cake. Because I remember it was the first film I watched with my eldest niece, and we had our first film buff conversation about it, and she was thrilled by this engorging of cake.
My cake scene would be the Grand Budapest Hotel, the exquisite cake that is made at the bakery and that you get the whole recipe for. And your mouth is watering whilst you watch this recipe scroll past in Wes Anderson's confection, which is as beautifully put together as any cake. Yes, so I would like to have delivered to me a Mendelssohn's Au Courtisan Chocolat. Because it sounds delicious. Yum, yum. Matt, what are you going for?
Yes, from my young childhood years, I do remember the lady popping out of the cake in Under Siege 2. But
is that the lady from Baywatch?
I literally can't even remember. Was it?
Yeah, Erica Eleniak.
Yes, it was her.
I think.
Yeah, she looked. Yes, she was probably on your mind because she was running in slow motion down a beach in a red bathing suit, and then she popped out of a cake in Under Siege.
As a young child, that was a scene that stuck with me.
I don't know why.
Made an indelible impression on a young cineast.
Is that
why you
got into film journalism? Because of that.
Was it even any good Under Siege 2? Wasn't that one of those action sequels that was going to be a different film and they just turned it into Under Siege 2?
I have to say, I have fond memories of Under Siege 2. So, but I imagine if we watched it now, it would be atrocious.
I imagine it's dated a little bit.
Not least because a girl jumps out of a cake.
Yeah, you don't see that so much now.
Indeed. Okay, so on that note, I think we'll say goodbye for now and look forward to next week when we've got some other goodies coming into the cinema. But for now, say goodbye, Matthew.
Goodbye.
Say goodbye, Matt.
Bye.
And it's bye for me. Join us next week. Bye.